2009. Thank you, everyone, for showing up this morning. We have a hearing and possible work session set on one bill. I'm going to do that bill first because I think it's going to be a relatively short amount of time that it's going to take to do that. And with that, I am going to open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2821. And I know that we have Juan and David. We have a number of people, actually. Now, everyone who signed up today on this sign-up sheet is here to testify on the family leave medical bill? I didn't think so. Okay. Fawn and David, would you like to come forward, please? Welcome and good morning. I think, David, you've been before us before, Fawn. I think this is your first time this session.
Yes.
Welcome. Pleased that both of you could appear today. Before the two of you start, I would just like, if there are others here who have shown up to testify on this bill, I would just like everyone to know that it is not my intent to move this bill out today. There are several very good employers who said that they think with a little bit of work we might be able to get to yes on this bill. And the couple of employers that have already approached me are ones that are always trying to do the right thing, and it is not my intention to in any way make life more difficult for the folks that are out there trying to do the right thing, paying the good wages, keeping people employed in this state, and moving our economy forward. So, yes, Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm excited to hear you say that because I was going to ask if we could maybe give a little more consideration on this myself this morning. So I appreciate that thought and sentiment.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. With that, please, if the two of you would determine who goes first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association. I apologize for not getting up when the bill was heard previously. I did manage to talk to a few of the members of the committee about some of our concerns with the legislation. I'm very happy to work with the chair and interested parties to try to figure out if there's a way that we can make this workable. Certainly for us in the school setting, we do think we're a good employer, and we do try to do the right thing by our employees. A couple of the concerns that we have with the legislation, there is, first off, there is a small cost concern as vacation gets deferred. It does get, it is a liability that the employer carries. It is required to be paid at some point, and that vacation over time gets more expensive as employee wages rise. So that is a small cost consideration. The other is that if an employee is not exhausting that vacation leave while they are on family leave, when that position is already being covered, if it is a teaching position or other position that is not something that we can just as a team in a school pick up the load, it might require an additional staffing, and this would, by deferring vacation, obviously that would require covering that position with additional staffing, a substitute, etc., at another time. So there is additional cost there. But really, one of the biggest issues we had with the legislation was under the current scenario where we have, for ease of numbers, let's say under a job protected leave, an employee has 12 weeks of job protected leave that they can be absent. Our read of the bill was essentially this would extend that job protected leave from 12 weeks to 12 plus however much accrued vacation an employee has. My human resource folks were concerned that when an individual comes back from job protected leave, if they were to desire to go immediately back out on vacation leave, an employer does have the right to deny vacation requests based on staffing conditions. However, if that came right on the heels of a job protected leave, there is the possibility, very strong possibility, that the employer would be that the employee could claim that the employer was retaliating against the employer for being on a job protected leave, and the likelihood was that retaliation claim would be upheld, whether or not it is an actual retaliation. So really what we were concerned about was that lengthening of the job protected leave, and if there was some way that we could work to find some sort of buffer or some sort of protection for an employer to be able to I don't know if it's work with an employee at the outset of a job protected leave or something at the end of that 12 weeks, 24, 36, whatever the mechanics of it be, so that the employer still has an ability to independently review a vacation request on the staffing burden of the district and to say, yes, that vacation request works just fine, or it doesn't, irrespective of the fact that that employee was on a job protected leave. So that would have been our biggest concern. I do appreciate the chair's willingness to work on that.
David, thank you very much, and I certainly appreciate your willingness as well, and your good faith efforts here. They are greatly appreciated. Thank you. Questions or comments? Fun. We're going age first this morning, beauty second.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Fawn McNeely. I'm here representing Tom Gallagher, who represents PGE. Tom is up in Portland, wasn't able to be here today. He did indicate that there are some concerns with the bill, but he's certainly willing to sit down in a work group and discuss what those concerns are and thinks that we can get a bill that works for everyone. So, if there are any questions for him, he can certainly follow up with you later today.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Questions or comments? I am, if you'd pass the word on to Tom, that
yes.
I'm going to ask him to sit in on the work group. David, if you're available, would love to have you. Lori Wimmer's in the back. I know an expert in this area. If you would be willing to join that work group as well, and Lori, if there's anyone else that you would like to have, that would be fine. The same goes for the both of you, or in this case, or Tom. If there are additional folks, and if there are a maximum of two members of the subcommittee who would like to sit on that, I'm not appointing anyone, but if you have a desire to do so, please check in with Kevin to make sure that we don't achieve a quorum. Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just clarification for timeline. Is this a work group that's it's a session work group, and you're looking for a resolution in the next so many weeks?
We're actually hopefully looking for a resolution here maybe in the next week or so,
okay.
And it would be my intent to have those folks meet Tuesday during this time period rather than maybe making folks get up for an 8 a.m. Work group, maybe 8:30, something like that would work if that's not too early.
Mr. Chair, I'd
yes,
be
please.
Happy to meet with that group.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair Huffman.
Mr. Chair, I would too.
Thank you very much, Representative Dembrough. We have our two, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I can do is go ahead and set up for 8:30 on Tuesday, set up a room arrangement. I'm spending a lot of time in work groups and a lot of different committees with these two representatives, so it'll be more of the same. So.
And I just want to comment, too, on Tom and David, not to exclude Fawn, but I know that both of them have served on both sides of labor relations. They are professionals. They are the kind of folks that come to this body to seek consensus and to find answers to issues. And I have the greatest respect for that approach and for everyone who appears on the work group. My only request is that you mirror the good faith that these folks have come forward with this committee on, and respect the fact that everyone in this process has wants, needs, and we approach it in that fashion. I want to thank you both very, very much. Thank you for your appearance.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'll get that clip and send it to my boss, too.
All right. Okay. All right. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify on House Bill 2821 before I close the hearing and work session today? Not seeing or hearing anyone, we will close that public hearing and work session. All right. I'm now going to open an informational hearing on the middle skill jobs. And our first panel, Kevin, need my glasses here. Hold on. All right, our first panel is going to be presenting on skills to compete, and that panel will consist of James Sager, Agnes Balassa, Kim Freeman, and Chuck Forrester. We may need an addition. We have an additional chair here. You folks are one step ahead of me already.
If we can avoid knocking each other over.
So, welcome to all of you. Thank you very much for your appearance. Please decide the order of your testimony among yourselves and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. Once again, James Sager from the Governor's Office. Appreciate being here, and I'll let each of the members introduce themselves here very quickly so you know.
Agnes Balassa with the Workforce Alliance.
Kim Freeman with Mount Hood Community College.
Chuck Forrester with the Lane Workforce Partnership in Eugene.
Chair Witt and members of the committee, the Oregon Skills to Compete formed less than a year ago to promote awareness of the need for highly skilled workforce. This is one of the many components of work that has been going on over the last couple years as we have continued to try to develop a tight alignment between education and workforce, and specifically tied to the workforce needs of the state of Oregon. The Oregon Skills to Compete Coalition consists of members such as the Oregon Business Council, the Oregon Economic Development Association, community colleges, AOI, Manufacturing 21, obviously the Governor's Office, and individual community college campuses, the Enterprise for Employment and Education, and Work Systems, Inc., and other organizations. The goal of the coalition is to provide the legislature, the governor, and other policymakers with objective information to better understand Oregon's dependence on those jobs that, as we've talked about before, require training beyond high school, but not necessarily a four-year degree. And so these are what we refer to as the middle skills job. 52% of our labor workforce are represented in these middle skill jobs. And so it is the largest section of our economy, and it is clearly the backbone of the middle class and the working class in Oregon. The goals of the coalition and the data, the report you're going to hear about in a moment, do align with the governor's priorities, as I mentioned. They align with the 40-40-20 vision for education, and they also align and bring into focus the Oregon Career Readiness Certificate that we have also talked about several times. So, again, to emphasize, this is another one of those pieces of this coordination that has been going on so that, in fact, we can move forward in an aligned way as opposed to having a lot of good ideas all kind of at odds with each other. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Agnes to talk about the report. And if you don't mind, I'm going to back away, let Chuck move over here because I have to head off to another meeting in a few minutes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, James. And good morning to all of our panel members. Welcome. This is almost like a reunion meeting. I used in a former life, I used to work with these folks with some regularity. So
yeah.
Good to see you all.
It's good to be here. Chair Witt and members of the committee, I'm Agnes Balassa, the Regional Field Director for the Workforce Alliance. And before I go into my testimony, I just want to draw your attention to the blue folders that you have in front of you. In the blue folder on the left-hand side, just behind my written testimony, is a copy of our report, which is launched as of this morning. So it has been embargoed up until today, and those who've seen it have been under pain of death, not to mention anything
This is the rollout, right? We are honored. Thank you so much.
On the right-hand side, you'll also find a copy of our press release, a list of the advisory committee members who have participated, those who've endorsed the campaign so far, and a fact sheet about the campaign. The Workforce Alliance is a nonpartisan, privately funded coalition of employers, labor, education, and training providers, as well as public workforce officials. As the regional director of the Workforce Alliance, I provide workforce development technical assistance, policy analysis, and support to organizations in 9 states in the western U.S. Before taking this position, as many of you know, I worked locally with the Enterprise for Employment and Education, a local workforce investment board, which gave me lots of opportunities to partner with organizations like the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, Manufacturing 21, and a number of others around issues of workforce development. And I've also had the privilege many times of coming to speak before this committee, for which I'm very grateful. First, we want to thank the committee for addressing the urgent training needs of Oregonians who deserve the quality opportunities that Oregon companies are eager to provide. The Workforce Alliance is the convener, along with the Oregon Community College Association, of the local Oregon Skills to Compete campaign, and also we are the convener of the National Skills to Compete campaign. And what we're here to do today is to provide some critical information to support your efforts and to help you as you develop policy and invest resources to support workforce development, education, and skills training. Several times in our history, visionary leaders have acted boldly to align education with the economic realities of the time in order to better support our economy. The promise of a high school education for all Americans matched the needs of the Industrial Revolution in the 1920s. In the 1950s and 60s, the GI Bill fueled the post-war economy by sending 2 million people to 2- and 4-year schools and twice as many through vocational training. That was the engine for a lot of our economic growth in the last half of the last century. Today we're facing a new economic reality, and a bold response is required once again if we're to foster economic growth and innovation into the 21st century. We want to start by explaining that there's a myth that is out there that's been gaining a lot of support in the last 10 years or so, this idea that the U.S. is rapidly moving towards what we call an hourglass-shaped economy, an economy where you have a relatively small number of highly paid, high-wage, high-demand jobs at the top that require large chunks of education, and a vast, vast economy where you have low-skill, low-pay, dead-end types of jobs. What this myth does is it totally ignores the middle section of our economy, the section of our economy that fueled the world's largest economy over the last 50 years and has been the foundation of a robust middle class. Our report today is here to say that that is not disappearing and that this middle section of our economy continues to be the bulk of the jobs for Oregon as well as the U.S. The report on the left-hand side of your packet shares a number of facts that I'm going to run through fairly briefly today. The first is that the largest section of Oregon's economy has jobs that require more than a high school diploma but less than a 4-year degree. We call these middle skill jobs, although many of them are highly technical, many of them are very highly skilled. Middle skill only refers to the level of education that we're talking about for these jobs, and it was just a way to capture this middle chunk. We like to think of them as that middle 40 in the governor's 40-40-20 plan, more than a high school diploma, but not necessarily requiring a 4-year degree. Many of these jobs are extremely well paid, many are unionized, and many, because they're in our communities and hands-on, are hard to outsource. Your electricians, your auto mechanics, your firefighters, your respiratory technicians, all of those that you can't just ship overseas. And this segment of our labor market counts for 900,000 jobs in Oregon. Second fact, Oregon is projected to have over 340,000 openings in this category between 2006 and 2016. This is on page 7 of your report, by the way, so there's lots of data there for you to go back to when you have more time. That's about twice as many job openings as you have in the non-skilled category, and more than twice as many as you have in that high-skilled category, the four-year degree and above. These jobs are in every sector of our economy, from healthcare to manufacturing to the skilled trades to finance to transportation. In fact, page 9 of our report provides a sample listing along with the projected earnings for the next 10 years. And the fact is the median wages for many of these jobs exceed the Oregon median of $31,000 a year or so. Fact, Oregon does not have enough workers trained to this level to meet current demand. In 2004, 52% of Oregon's jobs required more than a high school diploma, less than a four-year degree, yet only 47% of workers were trained to that level. In 2007, only 46% of workers were trained to that level. And so what you're starting to see is this decline, especially that's about to be exacerbated, especially as highly skilled workers continue to retire, unless we train up for the future. Fact. The skills needed in the emerging green economy closely mirror the middle skill demand in today's market. According to some of our research, most green jobs are middle skill jobs. 66% of employment in energy efficiency, 71% in wind technology, 56% in the biofuels all require more than a high school diploma but less than a four-year degree. Yet most of our focus and investments are around those young people who have just graduated from high school, those people under the age of 25 who have just graduated. That's where we tend to put our emphasis and focus. Two-thirds of the workforce of 2020 is already in the workforce. And so solely focusing on either the high or the low end of this spectrum doesn't get us where we need to be. Fact, between 1997 and 2005, American workers on the whole saw only an increase in wages of 5% when adjusted for inflation, yet at the same time, many of the jobs in this category saw much more significant wage increases. And as you've heard in so many who've testified before you before, even as the demand for highly skilled technical folks remains high, it's becoming more and more difficult to fill because of the lack of programming available. So I'm sure most of this data is not a total surprise. I know you all are good consumers of data. You're among the few who've taken the time to really try to understand this system in great detail. A lot of the data that we've used for our report, same sources that you all have looked at from the Oregon Employment Department and others. I think what's a little different is the way that we've framed it up to try to tell this story about this chunk of our economy. And really the question is what to do with the information that we're presenting to you today. Our answer is fairly simple. We believe that there's a tendency to focus on the 30% of jobs that require a four-year degree or more, and or the 20% that require no skills beyond a high school education. We agree it's important to assure that every Oregonian completes high school, but a high school completion alone is no longer sufficient to compete for the majority of jobs in our labor market. And it's unfair to expect high schools to be able to meet the demands of all the industries and the diverse jobs that we have out there today. We also believe that it's important to promote the completion of four-year degrees as part of Oregon's economic development strategy. However, single-mindedly focusing on that leaves this 50% of our job market behind. And so what we're asking you to do is to also focus on that middle 52% of jobs in Oregon, jobs that are going unfilled because we do not have a sufficiently trained workforce to fill them. This is why we were excited about the governor's 40-40-20 plan, because it's unusual to see that middle 40 that he talks about there in plans, because people tend to focus at the top and the bottom. So what's the best way to assure these jobs in the middle are filled? It's guaranteed access to the equivalent of a two-year education or training past high school, leading to a career or technical credential, industry certification, or the first 2 years of college, to be pursued at whatever point or pace makes sense to individuals based on their life situations and the needs of the industries that they're training in. We realize that's a lofty goal, but Oregon's known for visionary leadership. We realize this is not a one-session goal or a two-session goal. This is a long-term goal. But in every session, there are opportunities to lay pieces in place that can help with this. You as legislators have so many tools at your disposal that can help the state move towards this goal. You have the ability to affect policy and funding related to training and education, financial aid, systems capacity, improved assessment and remediation, social supports for adults while in training, mechanisms to help those who are collecting unemployment insurance access more training while they're unemployed. mechanisms to support private and public partnerships, and I know you've seen many suggestions and proposals come before you along those lines. We only ask of you that as you look at all of these proposals, as you consider all of the options before you, you keep in mind the 52% of jobs that require more than a high school diploma but less than a four-year degree, and that you keep working towards this goal of a skills guarantee, because in today's economy, we just know that high school completion alone is not sufficient. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Agnes, I've got some questions. I don't know if you'll have answers, but just my mind was reeling as you were talking. To fill the, I like the term skills 40, but anyway, we can use middle skills since everybody's kind of latched on to that. Middle just sounds so mediocre. Yeah. Middle skills 40.
We're not necessarily wedded to that. Has to be the end all be all term.
Okay. to fill the 51%. Is there any way of knowing how many of those jobs will be filled by this 17 to 24 age group and how many would be filled by the 25-34 age group? Mm-hmm. Is because we've heard from career colleges this week, and they said that so many of their students are actually the 25 to 34 age group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't have that data at my fingertips. I know that it's either available or a close approximation to it is available, and we could get back to you with some of that. What we do know is 2/3 of our labor market is currently in the labor market, and we do know that the age at community colleges has gone up. So we do know that more and more we are seeing those returning workers or people who possibly completed high school, didn't have a plan, spent a few years couch surfing, roaming around, trying different jobs, whatever that mix looks like, and then come back once they get a little bit more serious. Clearly, we'd like to capture those folks sooner. We just want to make sure we also don't lose this investment in adults who are really ready and focused and know where they want to head to.
So probably a good mix of the two.
Sure.
But targeting those two groups, they're probably in that 17 to 34, probably 3 to 4 identifiable groups from a marketing standpoint that you would have to get them in different ways. My second question was in the percentage of employees that do skill up. Do we have any idea how many of those are of entrepreneurial spirit that actually go on to become employers that are the job creators in another segment?
We can get you some more information on that as well. I don't have that data at my fingertips, though we did look at it as we were talking about this report. And Oregon ranks extremely high in that entrepreneurial category on a number of different studies. So it is a critical piece for Oregon, but it's not data I have right at my fingertips at the moment.
Well, I'm excited that those two questions actually have been looked at.
So. I'm very excited too, and I share Vice Chair Hoffman. I share your sense that we've got to come up with a better name, because I don't think is adequately describing the set of skills that so many of these jobs actually require. Again, we are honored that you're introducing your study here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Who's next? Kim is.
Yes.
Welcome.
Welcome back to you, too. Long time no see.
Yes.
Chair Witt and members of the committee, I'm Kim Freeman, and I'm the Dean of Economic Workforce Development and Industrial Technologies at Mount Hood Community College. I also serve on the advisory committee for the Skills to Compete Coalition here in Oregon. And I'm also vice chair, the community college representative for the Workforce Alliance, the national organization that is helping our work here in Oregon. I'm excited about Skills to Compete for a whole boatload of reasons, actually. And I think to your question earlier, Vice Chair, about who's going to be interested in these kinds of employment as well as educational opportunities, my 16-year-old daughter just told me yesterday what she wanted to do for a new employment opportunity, and in fact it is to be a wind turbine technologist at Columbia Gorge Community College. And Last week, it was actually just
Where's
to
the
be...
Where's the camera? Yeah.
Last week, she was trying to figure out a way to just get on Star Search. And so, you know, now it's a whole new direction. And having just gotten her midterm grade report, it does indicate that, in fact, she is ready to go on to college as well as to be able to go on into an opportunity for education and employment. But I digress. I am excited about Skills to Compete because I think it's a horizontal look, an all-inclusive, bipartisan look at the way Oregon has always done its work. We are collaborative by nature. We say that you involve your local communities, your local workforce investment boards, your labor partners, your training and education partners, apprenticeship programs, as well as business and industry to be certain that all of Oregon's citizens have an opportunity to participate in both the current economy as well as the new economy. As James and Agnes have called out, the 40-40-20 plan really helps to identify that as well. And I recognize the concerns around middle skill and what that may mean. I think after you read through the report, you may have a different take on it. But middle skill doesn't imply that it's the end all. In fact, it's just a midpoint up to 2 years post-high school of education and training that meets the individual workers' needs as well as industry's needs at the same time. It was also to call out the distinction between high-skill jobs, because middle-skill jobs really are about family wage jobs. But I'm also excited about this opportunity because I think it aligns with the work that all of you are going to be doing as you're making policy decisions for this next biennium. There are a lot of wonderful examples. I think Representative Dembro could probably give you a very comprehensive list of just of the certificate and degree programs at Portland Community College that really align with middle-skill jobs. But I also want to call out this national publication. Have you seen this, Vice Chair? Well, you'll be pleased because it, in fact, has a case study on the Columbia Gorge Community College wind turbine technician program. It's almost a commercial for the state of Oregon because it talks about the partnership between the industries there, the Workforce Investment Board, the community college's response to industry saying, we're going to need these workers right away. And again, it describes the articulation between community college all the way up to Oregon Institute of Technology. And it's clearly identified in this national report. And again, we can either give this to you electronically or have hard copies available for you.
It would be great. It would be
wonderful. I think there are other opportunities as well that exist all across the state of Oregon around middle skill jobs. Mount Hood Community College next Thursday will be graduating our second cohort of CNC machinists. And that group are folks who have been dislocated from their previous work, are ready to go back to work, even in this downturned economy, and are doing so after 6 months. It's just the first stopping point on a longer-term journey for education and employment. So, as Agnes said, I would just like to encourage you and support you in any way we possibly can as the leaders who are going to make decisions around how to help Oregon in this current economy, this current crisis, but also be prepared for our economic recovery that I know Oregon's going to be able to do because, again, we have a foundational belief that everybody deserves an opportunity to participate in Oregon's economy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments for Ms. Freeman?
Just a question or comment. If I could have a hard copy. Chair Witt and I are determined to support and make a difference. Oh, bless you. Thank you. And these two, along with the... And I call it Graham Slater. I shouldn't do that because I know that a lot more people were involved, but Graham is the one kind of identified with the Employment Department's book of the, you know, the top jobs in Oregon and broken out by
it's good stuff.
By workforce. So anyway, those are kind of my Bibles and guides as we proceed down this road this year.
Well, you can download that as well and hand out your own hard copies, or, again, more than happy to get you as many copies as you would like, but you can certainly have that one.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And thank you very much.
Chuck?
My turn.
Good morning, Chuck.
Morning, Chair Witt and members of the committee. My name is Chuck Forster. I'm the Executive Director of the Lane Workforce Partnership. We are the local workforce investment board in Lane County and Eugene area. The enthusiasm that Agnes and Kim exude, I feel the same, but I don't express it quite that demonstrably. So if you don't see me being quite as effusive, you'll know that I do truly appreciate Skills to Compete and the work that they do. I want to talk a little bit about the middle skill jobs as they apply to our local area, because I think that kind of brings it home, at least it does for me. I'll start with just reading briefly from a recent editorial that I had in the Register Guard back in early February. In it, I emphasized that training is critical to the success of any economic stimulus package. I stated it is imperative that young people are ready to work when they complete their education. It is also essential that adults have access to business-led technical training so they can return to work quickly and at the highest wage possible. The reality is that most good-paying jobs require skills beyond what most students have when they leave high school, but less than a four-year degree. And these good-paying jobs are those middle-skilled jobs that we've all been talking about this morning. One of the important ways we use middle-skilled jobs is that training for middle-skilled jobs is a strategy for moving individuals and families out of poverty. And let me give you an example of how that works. Amanda is a single mom. She has an 8-year-old son. She came to the Lane Workforce Partnership back in November of 2005. She was making about $11 an hour as a CNA in Peace Health Hospital. What we did is we worked with Peace Health and ourselves. We married our resources together. We created a plan for her where she became a licensed practical nurse a year after she visited with us. Another year later, she became an RN, and she completed a program in June of 2007, making $26 an hour. It's a tremendous change for her. For Amanda, finding assistance with childcare allowed her to achieve a $30,000 increase in wages per year, and this truly is a middle success story.
Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Chuck, how did she find you?
You know, it's interesting, Representative Huffman. We have, a number of years ago, created a relationship with Peace Health Hospital where we embedded our staff in the human resources department of that hospital. And we developed a strategy where we would work with the hospital to identify low-wage workers that they felt had potential, and then we would marry our scholarship resources with the hospital scholarship resources to develop a long-term plan. And those individuals would continue to earn and learn until they met their goal. And we provided staff support along the way as well for case management and support services at the same time. It's been a strategy we've been using now for probably 5 or 6 years, and you know we've graduated over 30 individuals, all with a post-secondary degree of one kind or another, and a number of them are now RNs in our local area.
So great, thank you.
So that's how that works. But again, those are middle skill jobs, and Amanda truly is a middle skill success story. I'll give you another example of how middle skills jobs are a way out of poverty. Jordana was a production worker making about $11 an hour. She came to us in the fall of 2003, and she didn't have the prerequisite skills to get into the nursing program. So we provided support for her to get those prerequisite skills, and 2 years later, she finally entered the nursing program. She ultimately graduated in the spring of 2008. This was a 5-year journey for her, and while she was doing that, she also was taking care of a young son. But by the time she was done, she was earning $57,000 a year. It was a 5-year journey, but it was a good investment for her, and again, a good example of how middle-skill jobs can help move people out of poverty. There's another point to her story, however, that I think is important to keep in mind, and that is that it is important for individuals to access middle-skill education and training at whatever point and pace makes sense for them. She couldn't do it in 2 years. She couldn't do it in 3 years, but she could do it in 5 years because it worked for her, it worked for her family, and it worked for her resources, and I think we need a structure within our state that allows people to do that. And, you know, and like most of you, this is probably the most troubling economy that I've ever seen, and I wasn't around the Depression, although some people might think I was, but I was not. You know, our unemployment rate in Lane County is officially about 12%. I would venture to say it's probably higher, 12 to 15%, and it's tragic. But at the same time, we often get asked, why do we need to invest in training when we've got all these unemployed people? And the answer that I think to me is pretty simple, is that we have an essential mismatch between the technical skills of technical skill needs of employers and the skill sets of so many Oregonians. In the Oregon's Forgotten Middle Skills report, it demonstrates that only 46% of Oregonians are sufficiently trained for the 52% of the middle skill jobs in our economy. And I'd probably argue again that that's probably understated, because we know that people need to begin, even those people with middle skills need to be continually retrained to be effective in the workplace. I'm going to give you one example of that. John was a middle class employee of Sony, and as most of you know, Sony closed in Lane County in the early part of our decade. And when that happened, he fell apart. We provided funding for training in a new middle skill job. And today he is making almost $21 an hour as a radiology technologist and making a middle-class lifestyle of life. Again, you know, it's training for middle-skill jobs is a way out of poverty, but it's also a way to stay in a middle-class lifestyle if that's the kind of lifestyle you choose. I also want to acknowledge that all the examples I've given you are healthcare examples, but we know that there are middle-skill jobs across all industries. The factor that links all these is the opportunity to access training beyond high school. And I think, again, the emphasis of skills to compete is to ensure, somehow guarantee, that every Oregonian has access to post-secondary training. And then I want to leave you just with three thoughts. One, middle-skilled jobs are essential to moving individuals and families out of poverty. I think I've said that three or four times, but I think that's really, really critical, important to remember. The two, access to middle-skill education and training to be pursued at whatever point and pace makes sense for the individual is key for success for many. We need a flexible education and workforce training system so people can move in and out at their pace. And if it takes 5 years, it takes 5 years. If it takes 2 years, it takes 2 years. Whatever it takes. And then three, we think there are a variety of things the Oregon legislature can do now and in the future to ensure that there are more Amandas and more Jordanas and more Johns. For example, providing greater access to scholarships for non-traditional students, covering the cost of child care for parents and training programs, and to continue to support for community colleges to train for middle-skilled jobs. And my only request for you, probably much like Mike, Kim, and Agnes, is that you consider the information you have here as you deliberate over education and workforce policy and funding over the remaining part of this session. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you very much, Chuck. Questions for Mr. Forster or either of our other panel members? Vice Chair Huffman.
The question guy here. Kim.
Yes. I don't have any other copies. So.
No. I'm most familiar with Columbia Gorge, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. But at Mount Hood, what kind of relationship does Mount Hood have with the Multnomah County or East Multnomah County high schools? Are they fairly integrated at this point?
I would say that it always is in flux, but certainly we're very committed not just to the citizens of East Multnomah County. We love going into, Representative Dempro's area, too, and working with Portland Public Schools, for example. But having said that, I think one of the ways that we're doing that is looking at new opportunities and collaborations around career pathways, identifying opportunities that start in high school and go all the way up through four-year degrees. And in fact, I'm more than happy to send you some career pathways maps that would show opportunities in healthcare and in manufacturing that start in high school and, again, go all the way up through a four-year degree. That's one example. I also think the federal Perkins dollars help support that collaboration and connection. And so there are new opportunities all the time. And, in fact, on May 15th, Mount Hood will be hosting an all-day event with the career counselors from all of our district's high schools to look at career pathway opportunities leading to middle skill jobs and having conversations about how we can provide better services back into the public high schools.
So it sounds like there's some collaboration, but it could be stronger.
I think collaboration can always be stronger across all facets of all the work that we do. But yes, we're very committed to doing as much as we possibly can, even in these really challenging economic times when we're short-staffed, but so are our local K-12 system. But
presently, there are opportunities for high schoolers to earn college credit while they're in high school.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck, I really appreciate you coming up again and testifying before this committee and in the legislature. And your work in the world of workforce is much appreciated, as it is with others. I just wanted to kind of share, some information that I have. And I don't know if I've shared this with the committee, but we've talked about it. During the interim, I had Graham Slater in the apprenticeship division really do a thorough examination of the needs, and it was to the year 2016 of skilled trades in manufacturing and the different construction trades. And as you focus on those, I hope that you take a look at those specifics, because it's easy to say, you know, this middle skill, and sometimes I think some of these trades are highly skilled in my book, because they're the original four-year degrees. Mm-hmm. But in light of that, you know, there are some trades that actually have a pretty good pipeline of supply of workers. And you always see the electricians mentioned, but when you look at the statistics going to 2016, their pipeline, it looks like it's ample to meet those demands. Mm-hmm. But conversely, if you look at some of the other trades like sheet metal, carpenters, cement masons, and, you know, you get into auto mechanics and diesel mechanics, and of course nurses is always at the top. You know, you see there is a huge demand. So I don't dispute your figures of the demographics that we have going on, and also of that huge need that we're going to have, especially if this economy starts turning around, which I'm hopeful that it does, as we see the stock market responding to Citibank. And, you know, so I've got a glimmer of hope out there. I'd like to, you know, spread throughout our economy. But when this economy does turn around with some of these initiatives and stimulus, that demand for the workers is going to be exacerbated, as we see the baby boom generation declining, and we're really not getting the kids into these programs. I just think it's incredibly important that we have that outreach that you folks are looking at, and getting kids motivated. And there's one last point that I just wanted to make, is that funding is always a big issue for training, and we have to do something. And I brought this up to the chair, and, you know, of ways that we can get some money, some hard dollars into some outreach with vocational educational opportunities for kids. And beyond that, when we do invest in that training, we want to make sure that those job opportunities are there for those interns, for those apprentices, that when things get slow, that our industries and our employers have a commitment to maintaining those job opportunities for the future workforce, so they aren't the first ones that get laid off and all the investment that we put into the training disappears. That's a culture that we have to have from industry and business, is that they make that commitment to the upcoming future workforce, that they have those opportunities and try to maintain them. I just wanted to, it's kind of been my, high horse, bully pulpit position, that we really identify those roadblocks, and that we really focus on where the needs are. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Representative Holby. Representative Dembro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hovey, for teeing that up for me. You know, that is, you know, I think a really key issue. It takes us back to the question of partnerships that have already been mentioned. And, Chuck, I appreciated your focus on the healthcare industry, because it's one that in many ways has been a model in terms of the healthcare industry stepping up and becoming partners in training programs, looking at their incumbent older workers, often minorities, first-generation college people, people who are just barely above poverty themselves, and giving them a pathway and ongoing support. I really think that's the model that industry in general should be emulating if we can.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously the word is out that healthcare is a place where there are jobs, and I know as a college teacher myself, many of my students, when I have that first sit down with them and ask them why they've decided to come back to school, they tell me they want to be nurses, and or some other kind of health professional working in allied health, and particularly those who are going to go into nursing, I am outwardly very supportive and inwardly very cautious, you know, when they talk to me, because I realize all the challenges that they have ahead of them. First of all, just the capacity challenges of, you know, I don't know if I told this story, but I when I was out door knocking, it was almost exactly a year ago, I think it was probably door number 5,500 or so, and it was knocked on a woman's door. She was in her late 40s, and she told me that she had been a student at PCC and had decided to go back to school at an older age. She'd been working in retail, wanted to go into nursing, was very had a lot of trepidations about going back to school and, you know, being the overage dummy in the class. Needless to say, as usually happens in that case, she was the 4.0 student, you know, and went, did all her prerequisites, applied for the nursing program. At the time, and I think it's still true, although it may change, PCC was so under pressure in terms of the number of applicants that it uses a lottery system. And this woman was very intelligent, but she had really bad luck. And she tried, her number did not come up. She tried the next year, her number did not come up. After the fourth time, she decided to go back into retail. And, you know, you just think about the loss there, you know, in terms of, you know, her own earning capacity for her family, for us as a society, that modest investment would be very quickly repaid to us, both in social benefit and obviously in tax benefit as well. It's it's the opposite of a success story. So that's one challenge. I mean, obviously we need to build the capacity of our programs, but also, you know, a number of students who are in that situation, they come to me for the first time. They're very deficient in math, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And although they communicate well, they're able to do college-level writing, their math is at the 9th or 10th grade level. And they have a long road ahead of them because they have to get their math skills up in order to do the chemistry, in order to do the anatomy, et cetera. And so, you know, those are the sort of the five-year commitment students that Chuck, you were talking about. And it really is important that we support them all along the way. One of the key things is, and that's where, you know, the pathways, of course, becomes a model, because the notion of just being in school for 5 years it's just untenable for people with families. So they need to think of it in terms of a pathway where they can work while they're going to school. And that leads us to the second big capacity challenge that we have, and that's being able to offer the classes that the students can take at the times they can take them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very easy to get classes and fill them up during the day. But, you know, running classes on weekends or sort of non-traditional times to deal with these non-traditional students is very difficult to do. And when the colleges are getting a lower allocation from the state, where are they going to cut? They're going to hold on to those classes where the enrollment is booming. But for those classes that are being offered at the more non-traditional times, they tend to be quite vulnerable. And that creates yet another layer of challenge for these students. So, you know, I think we need to be looking. We often look at student support in terms of tuition and scholarships, which is critical. But we also, I think, need to be thinking of it in terms of just can the schools offer the courses that the students need at the times they can take them. I guess that wasn't a question.
Okay.
You do agree with
you. Representative Holby.
Thank you, Representative Dimbro, for teeing me up. I just had one thing I think, maybe it's applicable to several. When Representative Dimbro is speaking of capacity, especially when we're talking about the nurse situation, you know, that, I mean, he's right on target there. And one of the things this committee has recognized last session and again this session is especially in the nursing programs, our capacity to have educators and trainers is a huge problem. And this committee recognized last session that we have this huge resource that we really haven't got on board to fill that lack of capacity in training and education. And I think it was Providence that took that issue and when I speak of those resources, I'm talking about the experienced nurses that we have out there that are highly qualified, that are making good money, but they're at a point in their career where they suffer burnout. And I know several of them in my community working with our hospital systems that basically take steps backwards because, you know, they just suffer burnout. And, you know, here's a huge resource that we could grab onto if we could figure out how to come up with the dollars to keep their pay up so they didn't take these huge pay cuts to become an educator. To help expand our capacity in training nurses. And I think it was Providence Hospital that had a model that was working on that. And I would hope that our other hospital systems would work with our community colleges in trying to expand that model to really step into this capacity issue. Certainly it doesn't fill the hole that we have at the state level for funding our community colleges who direly need that funding. But I think there's a potential there to help out there. So I just wanted to make that note. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I think Agnes has a comment.
Agnes, please.
If I may, Rep. Holvey, I think one of the things you've pointed out that's really critical is the private-public partnership piece of this. And I think one of our recognitions here is that this is not all a public issue either, and it's not just healthcare. There's other fields, too, where you have people, either because of the nature of the work, the physical demands, et cetera, that are highly skilled, but at a point in their lives where they could potentially teach others and would even prefer to do that. So I think there's opportunities along there. Some may have been already presented to you in some other conversations in the past to try to take a closer look at that. The private-public partnership piece is critical, though, to making any of this work. And as we talk about increasing the visibility of these jobs and filling the demand side of the pipeline, I think the challenge is not just in healthcare, but in many fields, the loss of skilled educators who are ready to go ahead and teach those classes, as colleges have had to cut back on courses that didn't necessarily fill in the past. So the capacity piece is huge as part of this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Could I just follow up real quick, Mr. Chair?
Please.
And one of the pieces to that, I think, is making sure that we don't, and I defer to my educational experts on this, but I know the Department of Education and others, they're able to look at these professionals and say, you know, what exactly does it take within our system to recognize you as an educator? Because obviously you have the knowledge, you have the technical ability and skills to show or teach people your trade or your profession. And I think there needs to be some, and maybe not, maybe it already exists. I know it does to some degree, but I think that our educational community needs to be more proactive at recognizing these professionals and getting them into a position where they can actually provide those educational services. Thank you.
Kevin.
Agnes, this is actually an off-the-wall question. I don't actually do this very often, but one of the things that this committee has seen and had a presentation was an ACE Academy model, and to give you kind of a 35,000-foot view, is a form of a public-private kind of collaboration along the lines of a charter school working with high schools up in the Portland area to teach some kids some skills and doing something like that. And it seems, not only in this discussion, but other discussions that have come up, there's, a deficiency in the nursing. I've heard it described as the hourglass, that you have lots of people and lots of need, but trying to penetrate that small middle spot. But one of the things, and I guess just curious about your thoughts, using, you mentioned the public-private kind of partnerships with respect to this, do you think there is room, and I don't know if it includes high schools or more along the lines of community college-age kids, where you can find those public-private ships or kind of expand on those public and private partnerships to get either in the high schools and the college to really start building and expanding that bottleneck so that things, especially where we're at now, I mean, can you give us some comments with respect to that?
Sure, and I can't speak specifically to the example that you have provided because I'm just not knowledgeable about it. However, Oregon over the last 5 years plus has seen a proliferation of private-public partnerships, what we often call sectoral partnerships or cluster partnerships they've been referred to also, depending on whether they just focus on one industry sector or whether they focus across industry sectors. I know that every workforce region in the state has these partnerships and I believe through this committee in the past and others, some initial seed funding was also provided to bring some of these partnerships to greater fruition, because one of the challenges in these partnerships always is having the resource to facilitate and coordinate those. Which described, though, really, in some ways, if you think back to your labor and industry partnerships, your JTACs, et cetera, I mean, some of those kinds of pieces also are very clearly along this same lineup. So we have a history of those. They've been expanding. They've been growing. Some of the work with manufacturing 21 and other groups has also expanded the reach of some of those partnerships. And at the federal level, the Workforce Alliance has been working on a sectors bill, which is specifically designed to try to bring resources to help foster and grow those partnerships. Because as you realize, when you get industry and education sitting at the table, you need to do some translation often. We speak different languages. There's challenges about how you translate what industry needs into what actually happens in a classroom, and then how do you put the systems together to package it up. And so I think there's a critical piece there, which is really the coordination piece around those that allows all of this to come together and really leverage what all of the partners can bring to the table. So Kim can speak more to Oregon examples.
Kevin, thank you, Chair Witt. I also want to give an example, too, where, again, that sort of sectoral public-private partnership has worked extremely well, and we're mid-process through this. We have a federal grant here in Oregon through the Department of Labor for the WIRED initiative, which is supporting advanced manufacturing. It's four community colleges: Clackamas, Chemeketa, Mount Hood, and Portland Community College, and four workforce investment boards. And the regional steering committee that oversees the work and guides the work of how we will implement and using those federal dollars, leveraging college resources, and actually helping to save state resources that flow through our WIBs. That regional committee is comprised of business, public sector, private sector, education partners as well. And it's, in fact, chaired by a business person. So I think, I can't speak to the ACE example, but I think that there are multiple examples where we are doing everything we can to be stewards of public dollars, including the federal money that we always look to utilize. And Oregon is seen as a great champion of being able to create innovative partnerships. And again, I think the WIRED initiative is one great example of that partnership.
Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. I would go as far as to say that a lot of our educational opportunities wouldn't take place if it weren't for the private investment into it. Agnes mentioned Manufacturing 21. Mm-hmm. At Columbia Gorge Community College, for example, the WinTech program and the nursing program would not be possibilities without the private investment. The the nursing program alone is 25% of Columbia Gorge Community College's budget.
Wow.
And it only affects, I think they graduate about 21 nurses per year. So when you think of the scope of everything they do, and for that 25% of the budget to be focused on 21 graduates is pretty amazing. And that wouldn't take place without private investments from Mid-Columbia Medical Center and all the other nursing facilities and hospitals in the Mid-Columbia. But it's $30,000 a year to educate one of the nurses. And the state portion of investment in Columbia Gorge Community College is $7,000 out of that 30. So without the private investment, of course, student tuition, that program just would not be in place. That's how critical the private part of it is.
Absolutely.
Great example.
Anyone else? I know that much of what we have discussed today kind of I think my brother's career is a perfect example of not only the public and private, but the need, as you said, to continually upgrade those skills. He was a welder, began as a welder with considerable talent. His employer said that if he would get a degree in metallurgy, that they would promote him. He did. Went on to be a highly specialized welder, and in fact, all of his welds were X-rayed. Mm-hmm. And were they not perfect, it cost a whole lot of money, so it had to be right the first time. Then his experience in metallurgy led him on to become a jet engine a mechanic, where again, a considerable investment by the private sector, by his employer, to enable him to do that. After becoming a jet engine mechanic, he went on then to be hired as lead and runs a bank of peaker power generation plant. And all the way, it has been constant skill upgrades, continual training. The training was obviously, given the nature of the work, was of the highest skills possible. And today, he not only has a very successful career, but with the exception of Bill Cluding in the back of the room, his paycheck's probably as high as anybody in this room. So Bill just woke up. So.
Got his attention.
So, folks, thank you so very, very much for your presentation.
And Chair Witt, you've actually provided the perfect segue into our second panel. We have just a few more speakers.
Uh-huh.
And one of them that you had on your list, Kim Wilmes from Metal Innovations, is unable to join us. They do work on airplanes, and two of her staff are here to talk about that work. Unfortunately, Kim is meeting with bankers this morning because of the tight credit situation that her company finds itself in. So in order to assure that she can continue to service all the contracts that their company is seeing right now, she is meeting with the bankers this morning and unable to attend. However, two of her employees are here today to talk about their experience with skills training.
Fantastic. Thank you,
Thank you so very, very much.
Our next panel, and I want to save a little bit of time if we can here today, because Bill Cluding has some late breaking news about some potential for some middle skill jobs here. But our next panel, Why Skills to Compete Matters, would be Kim Wilmes, Jim Stewart, and Justin Duffy. And Jim Azzamato.
Okay.
On the other paper. Good morning and welcome to each of you.
Good morning.
Thank you. Thank you.
Please proceed at your
Thank
your
you.
Own choosing.
Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Mazzamano, and I'm the director of the Education Research Institute of the Northwest Food Processors Association in Portland. You probably already know this from your other hearings, but over 25% of Oregon's land is in agriculture production, and as you know, that's for food, and so processed food adds value to our Oregon crops and fruits. You know, it's restating the obvious, but to put it in perspective, we need air, we need water, and we need food. We have 185 food processors in Oregon with a payroll of about $508 million annually. Oregon feeds the world, and we represent about 55,000 food manufacturing employees in Washington, Idaho, and Oregon. And after several years of decline this last year, the food processors in Oregon were the only industrial sector to increase their total jobs. Now we're up to about 22,500. And most of those jobs are middle-skill jobs. So in our smaller to medium food processors, we're probably 85 to 90% middle-skill jobs. And in our larger companies that are branch plants of national brand-name corporations, we're probably 90% or more middle-skill jobs. But if you hang out and mingle in some of the break rooms at any of these plants, you can't help but become aware of the increased discussion about golfing or fishing or whatnot, that you can really tell that some people are starting to plan on retirement. You sort of get the implied message, we're not going to stay here forever. This is not new, and I'm sure you've heard it for many, many years, but what's going to happen to us in the next decade, you're talking about, Representative Holvey was talking about Graham Slater's data, and that hits it right on, that work that they did. For the next decade, this frequency of retirement talk is going to happen more than we ever dreamed. It's way out of proportion of any other decade. And so we need to replace these workers with a different kind of worker, because the food industry has leaned itself down so that we don't have as many middle managers to do supervision and training. So the new middle-skilled worker that we're looking for in the food industry is the cognitive, innovative technician. And there's not a lot of job descriptions that have that yet, and there's not a lot of courses in cognitive or innovation technology. So we are spending our time communicating in partnerships with community colleges and educators to emphasize the need for somebody that not only follows orders in technician and electricians and plumbers, pipe fitters, and so forth. We need people that can analyze the trends of the problems after several repeated occurrences to create new ways to do preventative maintenance. And so we need thinking people that do more than just creative repair. We need people to create new technologies, to invent something in the company, to create a machine that didn't exist before rather than repair the one they've got. So at the Northwest Food Processors, our Innovation Productivity Center, we're seeking new ways to distribute the job openings as they occur, and want to increase our participation in the development of an education of a new ready to work workforce. That's one of the complaints of our employers, that a lot of people coming out of schools today just are not ready to work. They say they're ready to work, but they really aren't ready to work. They don't show up on time. They look at their needs. I mean, I understand it. Everybody has needs, but the trend of the population of the worker today isn't exactly a match in a manufacturing setting, and so we're looking for programs that can create a better graduate. The Oregon Department of Employment, again, probably a Graham Slater product, has recently estimated that an increased demand for new employees at 14.1% between 2006 and 2016. That's just the new employees. And so that's an additional 247,000 jobs that we have to educate in Oregon. And for every job opening that is due to economic growth, there's almost two job openings for replacement jobs of retirement. in the food manufacturing sector, that's more of a factor to us than the new graduates. And so at a recent meeting of our 16 executive board members that sit over the Northwest Food Processors, I asked for a show of hands of how many of the largest companies had done a retirement schedule database, which is simply retirement schedule planning. And only two raised their hands. And so I thought, well, you know, these are the big boys. They've got the big brand names. So I asked them, well, what are you doing to replace your workforce? And they said they don't know what to do. They're frightened. And the discussions around consolidating their national chain of several plants into fewer plants to match up the capacity of the educators to create the workforce. And so my message to you is that Oregon should be one of those states that wants to retain the food plants here, of the ones that are connected to national organizations. One of those employers said that 45% of their employees were going to leave in the next decade. And so on an average, that's really concerning to the leadership of the industry. Another employer raised his hand. He said in some work units, 100% of their employees are going to turn over in the next 5 years. And they can't replace those 30 years of people that have learned things on the job that could write the book. And so we have their attention, and they're looking for solutions. 42%, I think, in the same study, we found 42% of Oregon workers are 45 years or older. Some of the largest food processors that have finished their retirement data are really, I guess they're just besides themselves looking for answers. And so when you asked about partnerships in the previous discussion, that seems to be our number one strategy, is looking for partnerships with educators. So I think one of the things that I also took out of the Oregon employment data, the state's own data, an article was written by Brenda Turner, Replacing Workers, What Lies Ahead, is published last May. And of 13 industrial sectors across Oregon of employers, manufacturing was the one that had the highest percentage of replacement openings over the next decade. Manufacturing is 91%. We're going to replace 91% of the workforce in the next 10 years. And I can give this data to you in writing later on if you'd like.
That'd be great, Jim.
But it's the state's own data. I hate reading data, you know. I mean, who retains it? But 91% got my attention when I discovered that it's an issue. And, you know, that's one of the best things that Workforce Oregon does. I mean, they really provide us with information so that we can make better decisions. And this is not just an Oregon problem. I'm really kind of restating the obvious. It's a national problem, and so we're competing with others. And your competition isn't just within the state, because when a young person or someone that's been laid off from a plant gets retrained, when they get their certificate, where are they going to go? They're going to take they look at the calendar because they've got payments, and so they're going to take the job opening regardless of location. So we may be educating people for beyond the boundaries of Oregon. And Northwest Food Processors, we understand that because a lot of people stay in the Northwest. If you do a zip code study, they're going to maybe work someplace between Washington, Idaho, and Oregon. But a new factor comes in the equation, because Canada has recently passed some laws allowing an exception immigration for food processors. And so they're going to try to tap into some of our workforce too, because they recognize from a policy point of view that they don't have the capacity to train the employees they need either. And so just for your understanding, you're in a global competition even when it comes to creating a workforce. I'd like to update you on a couple strategies that we're doing in the food processing sector that really are, like Agnes described, a cluster partnership. Northwest Food Processors is engaged in is a excellent model down in Lynn Benton Community College, Albany. Public-private partnership with the community college, Oregon Freeze Dry, Inc., National Frozen Foods, the Albany School District, the City of Albany, and Fred Vetter is the vice president of Oregon Freeze Dry, and Bill O'Brien of National Frozen Foods. They see the issues here in terms of getting mechanical techs and people with the middle-skilled jobs, that they have to grow their own because the length of time their postings are on the job boards is getting longer and longer. There's a food processor in Portland that had a job posting up for 3 months looking for qualified people in mechatronics and electrical skills combination. LBCC and City of Albany have contributed dedicated classroom space to create a new program, and they've funded they've provided this classroom with enough workstations for food and beverage processing for 18 students, and their enrollment, their registration exceeds the capacity of the class. But it also, even though it exceeds the capacity of the school, it does not meet the needs of the industry for the next decade. So, and as was discussed earlier, these are dual certified courses so that some of the people that are in high school can currently get a toehold in the community college credit by attending certain courses that fit both. Again, we are really emphasizing with that particular project the importance of innovative skills to add that to their curriculum, and we're finding them very, very responsive. I think we need to kind of redefine the traditional job descriptions. The people that are leaving were very creative on their own, and I think that's the part of working in a manufacturing setting that you really can't put a stamp on 30 years of experience, 35 years experience of what their capacity is to be innovative on the line. And today's courses and people are educating them to certain functions, but I think one of our greatest challenges is to replace that on-the-job training to be reflexive and to be thinking. The WIRED program that was discussed earlier too is become a part of our future, and that we're looking at a portion of the WIRED grant to train senior workers into leadership roles of lead supervisors. And quite commonly these are people of Hispanic, Latino, or Cuban heritage. Oregon Food Manufacturers is like a United Nations right now. I know of one plant that is owned by a Japanese company, so its administration are Japanese nationals. They have some Americans that are in human resources and finance to match up with our regulatory requirements. And then they have processing lines that are composed of Ukrainians, Cubans, Cambodians. These are all Americans. You can see Cubans, Cambodians, Ukrainians, Russians, and Latinos, not Hispanics. And they're making Chinese food. Go figure.
Yeah.
But that's America. And so part of what we're going to use the WIRED grant is to start with Spanish and work towards our other languages and teach supervisory skills in that language. There's certainly a bias throughout the industry and throughout the communities that we shouldn't be teaching anything in Spanish, but on the other hand, we sort of have a gun to our head because we don't have employees. We can't choose cultures when we hire people, and it's just the way that diversity structures happen in the food processing industry. So anyway, that gives you a little window into some of the things that we're doing. We have food processors that are facing unprecedented challenges in workforces. We're looking at companies that may want to consolidate their plants to fewer across the country, not because of the cost of food or the location of the materials, just because of the location of the workforce, the best flow of the workforce. I just want to really emphasize to you that it's really cheaper and easier to retain a manufacturer in Oregon than it is to create one and bring one in and recruit one. And so we'd like you to remember that the middle-skilled jobs really are the backbone of Oregon's manufacturing industry, and that everyone must eat every day. So thanks very much.
Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Jim. I think I know the answer to this, probably all of the above, but lack of workers, lack of skilled workers, lack of drug-free workers. What are the problems? Is it all three?
Yes, it's all three. The location of the jobs is someplace close to the agriculture supply, and we might be educating the students in a location that they're not used to living in. The general supply, I think, of graduates, the type of classes that we have, it's all very important. We have the classes. Don't get me wrong. We have some excellent educators, but part of it was mentioned about the pay difference between the educators and the employees in the health sector. The health educators are not paid as much as a ER room nurse. They can make over 100,000 as a ER nurse. And in manufacturing, I think we find the same thing. It's hard to find qualified instructors. I think the program in the Dalles in wind technology, wind technician, wind generator technician, we started it up. We showed the demand. We had more people registered into the program, and the funding of the program went away. The need didn't go away. And then when you talk about drug-free employees, it's very difficult for government to require a drug-free graduate. But industry can. We can, in our scholarships, we can put a proviso or a rider on a scholarship that requires somebody to be drug-free to get the scholarship and drug-free when they graduate. And we have the potential to create a drug-free certification program to go with a middle skills job. That's another discussion on another day.
Additional questions or comments?
Yes.
Real quick, Mr. Chair, I appreciate Jim's comments, you know, and I know the committee's used to hearing me talk about construction and the huge need there, but when you look at the manufacturing sector, the figures are extremely alarming when you look at that whole manufacturing base as a whole. He's absolutely correct. It's just as dire projections for the workforce as we have in the construction industry.
Well, and his figures that we're going to have a virtual complete turnover in a decade, if that doesn't wake us up, I don't know what will. So,
yeah.
I just want to share with you a little story here about Jim and the fact that he truly gets and understands workforce and economic development. I became a candidate once in the short span of 3 hours, and then it was like, uh-oh, now what do I do? And I had read a newspaper article that featured Jim in it. I said, well, I got to see this guy. And the next morning, I was in his office, and I asked him, I said, you know, what are the things that someone needs to be concerned about in terms of workforce and economic development? And Jim told me, he said, you know, it's always great when you can attract the big employer. He said, never forget about the folks that have been in business for a long time and have built the community and have provided the workforce and paid the taxes for years and years. In a direct quote, never forget the onesies and twosies. And it's advice that I have never forgotten, and it was some of the best advice, Jim, I've ever received. And those onesies and twosies that he was talking about are those self-employed and the folks that are able to hire on the additional person and build a local economy. It was great advice, Jim. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chair Witt, and Vice Chair Huffman and I were talking a little bit before the meeting too, and similarly, I was explaining just the same concept that in small business, those jobs aren't going to India. They're not going to go to China. They're staying here.
That's exactly
our dirt, right? Staying here. Our vegetables that we grow are going to stay here.
That's exactly right.
That's your investment into food processing and small businesses is always going to yield a dividend for for years to come.
Well, thank you so much for all of your efforts in behalf of this state and your community. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you, sir. I'm Jim Stewart. I'm an employee with Mental Innovations, Representative Witt, Vice Chair Huffman, gentlemen. I started my career probably back when I was about fourth grade or so. My dad sent a picture of me when he was in Vietnam. He sent a picture to me of him standing next to a Cobra gunship, and I knew then and there that that was what I was going to do. I was going to work on helicopters. And after 21 years in the Army, repairing helicopters for our country, I finally decided to get smart and come to Oregon. It took me 39 years to get here, but I'm finally here. I brought my family here and settled in, and wound up going to work for Mental Innovations. And it's kind of a long way getting there. I met Craig when I was going to A&P school. I wasn't able to be employed as a aircraft mechanic without having the necessary certification. In order to get the certification, I had to go to school. And that required, that wasn't a college degree, that was something that was a vocational training, a two-year school that I did there at PCC. I met Craig in his shop, which was his garage next to his home, way back in 99, and I've been with him ever since. I've seen him go from his garage to a shop in Canby, and it was kind of funny there, because whenever anybody asked me what I did, I said, well, I work on helicopters, and, you know, I fix airplanes. And they said, so where do you work? And I said, well, I work in Canby. And they said, well, I didn't know Canby had an airport. And, well, they don't. And that's because we're a repair station. We take aircraft components, and we overhaul them, we repair them, we return them to serviceability, and take them back to the customer. But Craig wanted to expand his employee base and his capabilities, and that required moving to the airport. So we wound up moving out to Aurora Airport there on the south end next to the Jet Center. And we've since expanded. We've gotten a second hangar. We've expanded our employee base from, I think, 6 people to about 15 now. And we're just really going places. I can really, you know, I'm listening to the numbers being put out in the statistics and the percentages, and I'm really excited because I'm seeing a focus on what I always thought was kind of the lost element. And I can really put faces to those numbers because I'm a family guy, and I've got four children who are either in high school or have graduated from high school. Two of those children, my daughter is currently attending Portland State in forensics, so she's got her college career going. My son is going to be a marine biologist, and he's just starting his college education there at Clackamas Community. Now, my other two sons, one guy is just out of high school. He knows he wants to be a motorcycle mechanic, but he's not really sure where to go to get the training for that. And my other son, he's assembling sandwiches at Subway, and he's not really sure what he wants to do other than party. but I can see that this is what we're talking about today is the incentive that these guys need and the direction that they need to figure out what they're going to do with themselves. And it's really exciting for me to be here and be part of this and just be able to share some life stories there.
Well, Jim, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Thank you very much. Very, very much. Justin?
Yes, hello. I don't know if I can top that, and I wanted to say that I felt a little underdressed when I came into this party. I've never spoke before, but Kim Wilmus asked Jim and I to just share our stories with you and I guess put a real aspect to what you guys are talking about.
Well, thank you for being here.
And I don't have any numbers for you except for one, and that's me. Sure. My story is a little bit like Jim's kids. I'm 32 years old, but I graduating, I had the military as an option, and I really didn't want to take that option. But I ended up getting some tough love from my dad. I spent a lot of time chatting on the internet back when you had to pay for it by the hour, and ran up a $700 phone bill, which led to me leaving there. And I ended up having to stay with my girlfriend's parents, who's now my wife. But where that ties in is it gave me a drive to seek education. And I didn't have any money or funding for education. I actually had her dad told me about grants and that I could do the paperwork and fill it out. But I found out that I wanted to do some maintenance skills, and I didn't really want to follow into the automotive sector, so I went to aviation and seeked out that, and they have a great course out at PCC Rock Creek campus. And for me, living in Salem, to drive to Rock Creek every day was quite a task, but I'm glad I finished it. It's an 18-month course. ANP stands for Airframe and Power Plant. It gives you the license to work on anything that the airframe or anything the engine involved on that airplane. It's one of the few schools that I know of where you actually have to punch a time card. Every day when you go to school, you punch a time clock and you sign out for break. And I find that interesting because we talk about drug programs and stuff. The Federal Aviation Administration has a very strong drug policy. And one of the requirements is that they want to make sure that you have attended the school. And the way they do that is by a time clock. Anyways, I got out of AMP school and I started making $9 an hour at the Salem Airport, and I thought, man, I went to school for this, you know. AMP license just gives you a license to learn. But one of the things, now at 32 years old, I graduated in 97, so I've been in aviation for quite a while for my age, I consider. But one of the things I'm thankful for, and one of the things that I try to convey to the youth when I see them getting into our work process, is I try to say I've always had something to fall back on. I injured my knee back in 94, and I felt like I couldn't crawl around aircraft anymore, and I got out and I actually got a job working on school buses, just doing maintenance, routine maintenance. And the only reason I got that job is because I told my boss that I had a license in aviation. Another thing I remember is back in school, I remember A&Ps being taken left and right by elevator companies from New York because they really liked our technical ability to understand things on just a very technical level. So I was kind of going to joke with Jim over here that some of the answers to manufacturing it would be aviation and power plant mechanics, because when they started introducing planes, I mean, they were taking the best of plumbing fitters, the best of welders, which Jim's doing, the best of electricians, engine mechanics, even seamstress back when fabric airplanes were built, and now sheet metal, and then now in the future it's all composites. So I'll sum it up just by saying that we've been... I appreciate Kim's time at Metal Innovations because she sent us... I've been involved in three classes. I've been involved in a flame spray class. I've been involved in a composites training class. And I actually recently got sent up to Seattle at a AVL conference which discussed engine manufacturing and turbine maintenance. So if it wasn't for her putting the time and investment in her employees, I probably wouldn't be where I'm at today, which is in the quality department. And... full time I spend researching specifications and aircraft requirements and making sure we're in compliance with the regulation. And the only thing I can add to Jim is that we have a full manufacturing facility now, and we do two projects. We have an STC project, which is a supplemental type certificate or a modification to an aircraft, and it's a lot bigger deal than just modifying or putting new car parts on your car. You actually have to get FAA approval to do these. So we're working diligently on those and growing. So.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Questions or comments for Justin or Jim? Representative Holby.
Thanks. Just a comment to Jim. I appreciate you getting smart and coming back to Oregon with your skills. I've been waiting 10 years for my son to get smart and get out of the Army and come back to Oregon. He's highly trained in the medical field. But right now, I'm not sure if he's the smart one or me. So I haven't won that argument yet. So.
Keep working.
We'll take him.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stewart, you said you had a picture of your dad with standing next to a Cobra. Do you see your dad much?
Actually, my dad's dead now.
Okay, well, then I want to thank you for his service. And more importantly, I know it never happened to your dad because I, too, am a Vietnam veteran. But I wanted to make sure he was welcomed home.
Thanks, son. He's first cat.
All right. Thank you both. Anything further? Gentlemen, thank you all very, very much. Certainly appreciate your taking the time out of your work schedules to come down here and share the information with us. I'd like now to call up, please, Bill Cluding. There were a number of folks for a good number of years that were attempting to bundle jobs in the woods together and make that into a career that kind of fits into this middle skill level of employment. And in fact, this committee in the last legislative session took a good look at some of that. And Bill has an update on some information coming from Washington, D.C. in that regard. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Committee for the record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. I apologize for not having this in your hands this morning, but I have been running loops trying to figure this thing out. But I will have a copy for each one of you. This is a letter from Abigail Kimball, the head of the U.S. Forest Service, and it's to all the regional foresters, deputy chiefs, you name it, it's to all of them. And from what I understand, we're looking at $650 million that the U.S. Forest Service is getting out of the stimulus package. How much Oregon gets, I don't know. But I'll just read some brief clips out of this, and then I'll tell you my thoughts on where our problems are going to be. It starts out, when President Obama signs the American Recovery and Reinstatement Act of 2009, we will have an incredible opportunity to contribute to this historic national effort by providing jobs, to reduce the threat of catastrophic wildfire, to communities and forests across the landscape, improve forest health, move the nation closer to energy independence through the use of woody biomass. However, we are going to be expected to move quickly to creating jobs to aid our weakened economy. The major purpose of this is to create jobs, promote economic recovery, especially to those impacted by the recession. I think we could blindfold ourselves and throw a dart at the Oregon map, and no matter where we hit, we need help. We anticipate using the information collected from the field to respond to the request of spending plan within 30 days of this bill being signed. And to provide the department with a sunset of projects that can be underway within the first 7 days of enactment. I don't quite understand how we're going to accomplish this since we're past the deadline already. Some bullet points. Create and retain jobs in economic distressed areas. Create and retain sustainable jobs. Create or retain jobs that help sustain the health, diversity, and productivity of the nation's forest and grasslands. Leverage other resources to create more jobs. I did not see anywhere in here where it says family wage jobs. Your prompt assistance with this information is greatly appreciated. It's imperative that the Forest Service make proper and prudent use of the funds which may be available to provide the stimulus to the American economy. Committee, I'm asking for help here. Where is our trained workforce for this type of work? Who in the state of Oregon is sitting down today with the U.S. Forest Service and drawing up these plans? And I'll probably be stepping on some toes on this, but surely they must realize back in D.C. what has hurt us for the last 20 years in this state is the Not the conservation groups. It's the radical environmental groups have tied this up into courts. If we get a workforce trained, if we go out on the job, what are they going to do? Send them back home while the judge is sitting mull over what they're going to do with the appeals that are going to come in? Committee, again, I'm asking your help. I'll have this in your hands today. How we're going to go about this, who we're going to talk to, I have no idea. But, again, we need the jobs. Somehow, somebody has to pull all this together, and they're talking about 7-day shovel-ready jobs. We're going to need some help on this. I ask in your health committee.
Thank you, Bill, for bringing this issue before us. I know from previous sessions, I know from the work that you've tried to do in the past that we have, as you stated there, the opportunity to improve forest health here in this state. It's a tremendous amount of work that's to be done. There are a lot of skills out there. We got folks that can run shovels out there. We've got folks that know how to do arborist work. We have folks that can be doing stream bed improvements, and all of those things go into these projects. If we bundle it all together, it has the potential for possibly being long-term. It's going to require some folks with some considerable amount of skills, not only in the work that they're putting on the ground, but also their organizational skills. And we can't afford as a state to overlook this opportunity. I'm inclined to, here in the very near term, invite in some of the folks from the Forest Service, perhaps invite in some of the folks from our State Department of Forestry. I recognize that this is a federal program, but we've got some of the most highly skilled foresters. We also have the best-run forest in the world right here as our own state of Oregon State Forest. These folks know what they're doing. There's folks like yourself who have tried to put this together in the past. If we tried to put together a hearing Thursday, is that a good first step?
Chair Witt, committee, yes. I don't even know if the employment department knows about this.
Well, that's another group we probably need to have in for this hearing, too. Representative Holvey, Representative Dembro, I think Representative Esquivel will just go right down.
Thanks. Just a real quick comment. You know, thanks, Bill, for bringing this to our attention immediately. It's unfortunate that Chuck Forster just walked out of the room, you know, because he works directly with a workforce partnership in Lane County, WorkSource Oregon, with the employment department, and I know that there is a pool out there, albeit it's probably not sufficient for everything, I think we need to get them online on this.
We'll get Chuck in here if we can, then maybe.
Instantly, and beyond that, for the sustainability piece, I know there's federal monies and also outdoor youth programs, and you know, we've had the Northwest Youth Corps, who is exposing kids to these sorts of opportunities in our force today, and have been for many years, and hopefully we can expand that. They turn kids away because they don't have the capacity to have enough contracts out there for them. And these are highly motivated kids. And then we also have the at-risk population through OYCC as well. I'm not saying we can solve this problem, but certainly we got a couple pieces that we could throw at it.
Well, if we get a chance to get some jobs, we need to have workforce readiness, not only shovel readiness. Representative Dembro?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Bill, thanks a lot for bringing this forward. I was actually in a similar conversation yesterday in the healthcare area where, you know, people are concerned that there are, you know, there's a pot of money that's waiting for us in D.C., and it's probably going to be distributed, a lot of it, through competitive projects. And in the healthcare area, they don't have these projects put together. And it is critical that we not allow other states to get ahead of us, you know, in putting in those requests. It's very, very timely. And we need to make sure that these projects, whatever we're designing, can actually lead to something. I really appreciate your comment that they're not just Band-Aids, because this is one-time money, and it's got to be used to inject energy to something that can continue.
If we show a little bit of leadership here, maybe we can turn this thing around fast enough. Representative Esquivel, then Vice Chair Huffman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill, repeat the time frames to me, because I heard a week, and I'm going, holy cow. First of all, it would have taken the federal government more than a week just to put out the memo.
Chair Whip, committee, these regional directors and foresters are supposed to reply by February 20th. And that's just about the time I knew that this was floating around. Projects are supposed to be in Washington, D.C., from what I understand, within 30 days. Most of those projects are supposed to be shovel-ready on the job in 7 days. I'm totally confused on how this can take
place.
How's
that going to work?
And Representative Hovey, and your comments, it says considerations, partnerships. There is a strong expectation that a portion of the work will be completed by Public Land Corps, Job Corps, Youth Conservation Corps, and other related partnerships.
Vice Chair Huffman and Representative Hovey.
If you're going to key on...
Well, I just know that the Forest Service has already been putting projects out, right? That's already happened. Some of our foresters have already moved that direction with some of the Job Corps, the Youth Corps potential. I don't know how fast the projects themselves are starting, but I know that the contracts are starting to come out right now. So.
Vice Chair Huffman?
Thank you, Chair Witt. I am starting to see, I think, a glimmer of hope. I think there's still a need to get high-level state policy on board with forestry and the demand that's there. And I'll just finish by saying Grant County is ready to go to work, Bill. We have a workforce that's trained in forestry, and they're waiting for the go button.
Fantastic. Bill, do you know, is that BLM in on this at all?
This is just U.S. Forest Service.
This is just Forest Service.
BLM is working their program parallel to this.
The reason I'm asking, I went to school with the head of the BLM here for mm-hmm. this district. I also was in ROTC with him. So as soon as we know that the BLM's in, we'll get him in as well. Folks, we're probably going to be doing this on the fly, but I don't know anybody else is trying to put something together. I don't have the answers, but maybe we can get some of the right people together in this room and see what we need to get going on this. Kevin?
Chair Whip, members of this committee, what I've got so far, and to the extent that there are parties, some of these parties listening, I would encourage you to contact me right away or my assistant, Keith Bassett. We're looking at the State Department of Forestry, Chuck Forrester, who's in here, the Employment Department, Northwest Youth Corps, OYCC, and also seeing if we can perhaps track down a representative of the U.S. Forest Service as well. To come in. So if legislative liaisons for those respective organizations, if you could contact us, we'll be contacting you otherwise. And if you could provide us with a copy of that, we can get some copies right away and disperse it out to the
Mr. Chair.
The committee.
And Bill, if you would, just it pops into my mind, the guy that Verl Steele, and I think you too, were working with the Forest Service, who was trying that jobs in the woods up in the canyon. Maybe we can get him in here. I mean, he's done the project before for the Forest Service. Maybe he's got some information to share with us. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, just a real quick thing here, Mr. Chair. On the U.S. Forest Service, I think we'd want someone that has the ability to speak for and someone that we can depend upon. I don't want they didn't have the authority to say that routine.
Yep, absolutely.
Anything further? Mr. Chair, I sit on the Siuslaw National Forest Resource Advisory Committee. I could contact them today.
It sounds good.
And ask them, you know, if they could help us out and,
you know, what the who the right people to talk to on this are.
This sounds good.
Members of the committee, just so that you know, I am actually going to be out of the office tomorrow and Monday with a family matter that has come up. But I would encourage you, to the extent that any of you get information or someone comes knocks your door, Keith will be available, and I will be in contact with Keith via cell phone to follow up if there's anything we can do to coordinate this. So,
Bill, if you or Mike Draper or anybody can get us somebody high up in the Forest Service, just go for it, okay?
Mr. Chair, if I may, maybe we should make sure the governor and his staff maybe could sit in on this.
Absolutely. Too. Absolutely.
It has to be from the top down.
Absolutely. Absolutely. With that, we're going to roll with the punches, see what we can put together. And, Bill, we thank you for bringing that in here. I'm going to close the information session, and we are adjourned.